From the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, this is Veterans Radio. And now, here's your host, Dale Thronberry.
And good morning, America, and welcome to Veterans Radio. Wow, are we excited to have you here today. We're going to be talking with an author of a great book about a World War II POW. Laura Edge will be on in just a little bit. But first, I want to introduce our air boss today, and my partner in crime and co-founder of Veterans Radio, 101st Airborne, Bob Gould. Good morning, Robert.
Oh, I love it. I love it. You know, we were at that air show this past... And by the way, folks, you can go to our archives and listen to some of the interviews that we did at that air show. But you know what I did? I wore my dog tags. And wasn't that something? Come on, all you folks out there, when you hear that, what made you a true soldier or sailor is when you put on your dog tags. Because there, that was your ID, and you were wearing it, man. And you didn't take it off, right? Right?
No, you never took it off. The whole time it seemed like you were on active duty.
And I had,
all you did was tape them so they wouldn't make noise when you were sneaking around wherever it was you needed to sneak around.
I had mine with me, and I had mine on. I really felt, feels good. Feels good.
Well,
brings back those good memories.
I want to thank the Yankee Air Museum for putting on Thunder over Michigan. It was a great show. Despite the lack of, quote, military aircraft, there was every other type of aircraft in the world out there. And I think that everybody I talked to was very impressed and came away from that with a much higher appreciation of what their veterans have done and what they are continuing to do. And I wanted to thank especially the members of the Army Aviation Heritage Foundation about what they did for us. And I want to bring on a member of the Army Aviation Heritage Foundation, a sky soldier himself, Mr. Gene Newton, better known as Fig. I just figured that one out.
I wonder why.
I don't know. Hey, Gene, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Hi, good morning. I appreciate the invitation.
Well, you were out there last weekend, and I got a ride on a Huey, and I want to tell you. And Laura, also our guest here today, got a ride last week too. So it was a great adventure for me. It had been 42 years since I'd been on one, and all those sounds just came roaring back. No pun intended, with that Huey. Tell us a little bit about the Army Aviation Heritage Foundation, would you please?
Yes, sir. The Army Aviation Heritage Foundation is a not-for-profit educational foundation and is dedicated to presenting the Army aviation story to the American people through the actual flying of aircraft and equipment used by the men and women who served in the Army aviation.
And you've got a lot of different aircraft, don't you?
Well, yes, sir. We've got four Hueys there. Three of them actually have combat time in Vietnam. As a matter of fact, the aircraft that you flew on last week has gotten over 2,200 hours of combat time in Vietnam. And we also have six flyable Cobras that we fix up and fly. And also, we take them, we do different air shows, and we also give rides in the Cobra.
Oh, wow. I've known about that. I used to just sit and admire the work that the Cobras did.
Oh, yes. If you've ever seen this aircraft in combat, it's just amazing to the maneuverability and the firepower that this one aircraft had.
So tell me, Fig, what was your job in the service? What did you do?
I worked in flight ops and flew as door gunner on the Hewitt.
Okay, and where were you in Vietnam?
I was with the H Troop, 10th Air Cav, at a place called Anson, which is a little northeast of Quy Nhon.
Okay. So you've got lots of experience of riding around in those little aircraft right there. I know that you guys put on demonstrations and are flying all over the country, it seems like, with the Heritage Foundation. And where are you going to be next?
Well, we were scheduled to be up in West Columbia, South Carolina today, but due to the weather here, the mission got scrubbed. But we've got a mission in a couple upcoming weeks, one to Ozark, Alabama, and then in September we have a show going to Tupelo, Mississippi, and to just name a few.
So you're going back to Ozark. Ozark happens to be the home of Army Aviation. That's where Fort Rucker is.
Oh.
And so you're going back there for a show?
Yes, sir. There's different people that want us to come put on the show there. Sometimes it's a reunion of a flight class. Sometimes it's like last year, the fort was celebrating a important mileage there. So we went down to show them what the old aircraft really were.
That's right. There probably aren't too many Hueys even there.
No, they have been taken out of the Army inventory. I think Fort Rucker's got maybe one left. But these aircraft have been taken out of the Army inventory, and they have been given to foreign countries for foreign aid, military aid. And, yeah, these aircraft are getting few and far between, not nearly as many as they used to.
Wow. Well, we need to get preserve a few more of those. I know I'm involved right now in a restoration of one here in the local area, and so I think I mentioned last week we're trying to find parts for it, and it's becoming more and more difficult. You know, we would think that there would be some sort of Huey graveyard somewhere like there are for the airplanes, but I guess not.
Well, no, if there is, we haven't found it yet. Yeah, that's the problem, that some of the things that we have to try to overcome is parts, and, of course, the main thing is getting these parts remanufactured, i.e. a set of rotor blades for a Huey runs somewhere in the neighborhood of like $350,000. And so, yeah, these blades that we have to have and everything like that, we keep up the aircraft not to the civilian standards, but to the military standards which they were originally flown in. So a lot of the parts are what we call timed out, that the Army says you can only use them for so long, mm-hmm. and then they have to be either rebuilt or done away with. So, yeah, it's going by the Army manuals and everything is Army maintenance guides. It's a test sometimes to find all the parts we look for.
Well, Fig, I want to thank you very much for being on Veterans Radio today and talking about the Army Aviation Heritage Foundation. You can go and find out more information about this. They certainly need your donations if possible. And that's at armyav.org. That's armyav.org. And you can keep these helicopters flying. It was such a thrill.
Oh, it was a thrill to hear the sound. I'll tell you, Gene.
Okay, I appreciate it, and we look forward to meeting a lot more people at our shows.
Gene, it took us a couple days to get the smile off of Dale's face. I just thought I'd let you know that, and it was perpetual, and I think it was frozen in there because he loved it so much. And thanks again for as much of the welcome mat that you boys all put out for Veterans Radio. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Thank y'all.
All right. Hope to see you again soon, Fig.
All righty.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Isn't it amazing you pick up a Southern accent right away just talking to us from Georgia? And
what was that like, Dale, after all?
What?
Folks, he hasn't been in a Huey in 50 years, 48 years. What was your thoughts? I mean, I know...
I think it was what was most exciting to me was just the sound and the smell of the thing. And I was riding with Maria, who, those of you who listen know that she's the one that does our Facebook and our Twitter stuff for us during the program. And I said, we're going to be going up now. And she says, how can you tell? And I could hear the whine starting to get tighter and tighter.
Yeah.
You know, it's like they're winding up the elastic band. And it just, in the next second, you know, we lifted off into a hover. And, well, I'll tell you, riding back there in the gunner's well was a little bit different than riding up front. Now I understand why they kept yelling at us to keep it in trim so the wind didn't blow you out of the thing. But it was they gave a great ride, and all the ups and downs and loops and everything else that you can do in a helicopter. It was a hoot, and I called a number of people that I had gone through flight school with and that I'd been in Vietnam with and told them about it, and they were actually jealous.
Well, folks, and I will close with this. I saw Dale sit in the pilot seat, and I don't know how he got in that pilot seat in Vietnam. I mean, you are too tall. What are you, 6'1", 6'2"?
I didn't realize that I was that big.
Yes, you were. I mean,
I was looking at the photographs that we've taken, and we're putting some of those up on our website, by the way, and hopefully they'll be up there soon. But I really took up a lot of space. I was wondering why I didn't get shot. I make a pretty good target there.
Well, anyway, folks, it was a good time was had by all.
Encourage people to go to the ArmyAV.org website. Check it out. They've got some really great videos and YouTube-type things there of what helicopters can do, and you can make a donation and keep these old birds up in the air.
And you can also go to YankeeAirMuseum.org, Yankee Air Museum, and see all kinds of plane pictures, photographs from the air show. Definitely check that out. It was a lot of fun.
It was just so cool. We're going to be coming back in just a moment with our guest this morning, Laura Edge. And if you want to get in on the conversation, give us a call here at Veterans Radio. That's 877-573-7825. We'll be right back after this message.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now, we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
I was trying to look for that. It's supposed to be Rockabye the Baby, the start of the war, or something like that. So,
well, you can sell that.
I was waiting. Yeah, I know. They have these long introductions, and it's supposed to be Rockabye my Baby, there ain't going to be no war. How about that?
Well, that's a nice grammar. But obviously, we're taking you back to the 1940s today. And all that music of our generation, when we were growing up, I can remember my mom and sister rolling back the rug, as they would say, and dancing around the dining room. My father would just sit there and watch them. I don't think he joined them too much, but I digress as usual. Right now, we're going to be introducing our guest of today, and her name is Laura Edge. And Laura has written a great story about her dad. It's entitled On the Wings of Dawn, American Airmen in Germany's Prisoners, as Germany's Prisoners. And Laura, I want to welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, this is a story about your dad. Your dad's name is Lawrence Witt. And Lawrence was from where?
My dad was born and raised in Detroit, Michigan. He went to the Henry Ford Trade School. And he graduated from there and then was doing an apprenticeship. And when World War II broke out, that's what he was doing. A year later, he decided he had to do his part. He did have a military deferment, but he decided to enlist in the Army Air Forces, thinking he would be a wonderful airplane mechanic.
Right. Well, we were talking earlier at breakfast. Bob is also from Detroit, and you guys are going to take you know, time tripping down memory lane back there. And it was not unusual for many of the high school students and so forth to be in trade schools at the time. And it sounds like he got a great background in what he wanted to do. Unfortunately, like most of us in the military, our duties changed as the need required. I want to give out the phone number one more time just in case you'd like to give Laura a call while we're on the air. It's 877-573-7825. So we're talking about Lawrence. Is it Lawrence Larry or just Lawrence?
Larry.
He went by Larry. Okay. Larry Witt has decided to do his duty and enlist. And where did he go from there?
Well, he did eventually, after basic, did get his diploma in aircraft mechanics. And he was slated to go to Santa Monica to be further trained as a crew chief. So that was the plan. But during the course of the war, there was a need for more gunners. So his orders were rescinded, and he found himself in gunnery school instead. Was made an engineer and gunner on a B-17 bomber. His crew flew a B-17 over to England, and that would have been in April of 1944 when they went over. He flew his first combat mission on April 27th, and then 15 days later, on May 12th, 1944, his plane was shot down on a mission to Brux, Czechoslovakia.
That was to that oil plant.
A synthetic oil refinery.
Let's talk a little bit, and I know Bob likes to jump in on this conversation with me, because we're going to talk a little bit about, I want to describe to our audience the B-17. And that, you know, this was the main bomber in Europe at the time, and it was not pressurized. You had to wear a pressurized air suit. You had to use oxygen, everything else, because these guys are flying at, you know, whatever, you know, anything over 10,000 feet, you're supposed to use oxygen. And it got mighty cold up there. And some of the outfits that they wore, I'm trying to get to the idea of what these men had to wear as airmen while they were flying these missions.
They had so many layers of clothing on that I often wondered how they could move. My dad always started out wearing his dress uniform. Now, that wasn't required. But
that's
he,
right, yes, I remember.
That was kind of his good luck talisman. He mm-hmm. felt like he was going to be dressed sharp. And he actually did say to me once that he did that because in the case he was shot down, he wanted to look like an American airman. So apparently he did think of that possibility. But and then over that, they had a jumpsuit. They had the wool-lined or the fur-lined jackets. They had the May West, in case they would go down over water, this would inflate and be their life preserver. The fur-lined gloves, boots.
Was he one of the ones that wore the electric suit?
They did have an electric suit, and that worked a little bit like an electric blanket. They would plug that into the plane's electrical system, and it would heat up.
So on this particular flight, or his assignment on the B-17th was that he ended up being a side gunner on the plane in addition to helping repair and everything like that, correct?
Yes, he was the engineer and waste gunner.
Waste gunner. Okay. So, all right, so now he takes off on this is, what, his fourth, fifth mission, something like that?
This was actually his seventh mission. And interestingly enough, in my research, I found out that was pretty average to make seven missions. So he was Mr. Average there. At the beginning, the required number of missions was 25 missions, and then they raised that to 30. But especially in the months before D-Day, it would be very hard to make that many missions. But I know people that did.
That's true. So after 25 or 30 missions, when they changed it, they would be rotated back to the States, theoretically.
Yes.
That was the goal.
They were done overseas with combat missions at that point in time.
I wish we could have done that. that would have been in about an hour. So So on May 12th, 1944, this is before D-Day. I mean, everything's getting run up to D-Day. So these B-17s and all the bombers are just making bombing run after bombing run over Europe. And what unit was he in?
My dad flew with the 96 Bomb Group out of Snitterton Heath, England. And I had the privilege just last May of visiting that airfield with a group of veterans and children of veterans that flew out of that field. So I got to see that firsthand, and that was a thrill to be there. And
well, you did a lot of traveling in writing this book, it seems like. I mean, you got to visit a lot of the sites where your dad had been.
Well, the person who was very instrumental in helping me do that was Heinz Hungerbühler, and he was a 15-year-old high school student in Usingen, Germany. And he was a witness to the crash of my dad's plane.
Wow.
And he contacted my father. He had been searching for airmen who flew on that plane. And he came to befriend an airman that was serving in Germany and ask his help. So he was able to trace to my father, and my father received a letter. And my father basically handed the letter to me and said, here, you take care of this. So I was delighted to do that. So Heinz and I had, 2 to 3 years we were writing letters back and forth to each other. And he kept inviting me to come to Germany. And finally, I just decided I will always regret this if I don't take him up on it. So my husband and I went off to Germany. And Heinz showed us where the plane went down. He took us to the air base where my father was first taken after he was taken prisoner, took us to the site of Duloglouf, which was the interrogation center. Most airmen that were shot down over western Germany were taken there first and were put in solitary confinement and interrogated there before being sent on to their permanent Stalag.
I find it fascinating to hear this. If you want to get in on a conversation, folks, it's 877-573-7825. We're talking with Laura Edge, who has written a book about her father's adventures as a POW during World War II. And I guess I have to go get into this part. He was shot down on May 12th. As briefly as we can, what happened to their aircraft? Because not everybody survived this crash.
Yes, the tragic part of it was that all the officers on the plane were killed, and the tail gunner was also killed. So out of a crew of 10, 5 were killed in action, and 5 became prisoners of war. What happened that day is the 96 Bomb Group was leading the mission, and the rendezvous with the fighter planes, their fighter escort, just did not take place at the appointed time and place. So the leading edge of the bomber stream on that day was left unprotected. Apparently, Germany decided to make this an all-out effort as well, and they sent up numerous fighter planes. When the bomber stream got to the point just north of Frankfurt, Germany, suddenly these German fighter planes appeared in mass and came flying through the formation head-on, and they took out many of the planes at the beginning of that stream. They flew through the formation 3 times. On the first time, my dad's plane was hit, but the pilot was able to regain control of the aircraft and was able to get back into the formation, and they flew on. Minutes later, it was hit a second time, when a missile flew through the fuselage and exploded in the tail. And that's when the tail gunner, Jennings Gruder, was killed. The third time the German fighters flew through the formations, the plane took on a lot of damage. The front of the plane was shot away. A fire started on the flight deck. The navigator and the bombardier were killed at that time. The The next thing that happened is, even though there was no order given, it was obvious it was time to get out of the plane. They were having a very difficult time getting the door open. Apparently, some of the battle damage had made that waste door, their escape hatch, warped, or in some way it just wasn't working correctly. So two of the men were back trying to get that door open. And finally, the hero of the day, Lloyd Stoller, just came running across the plane and put both feet on the door. The door gave way, and he went flying right out of the plane. And that paved the way for the others.
I want to remind our audience that this is not a stationary aircraft that they're trying to get out of now. This thing is in a dive from thousands of feet, and it's spinning while they're trying to kick the door open and stuff. And I can see that Laura's getting emotional just telling the story, even though you've told it many times, I'm sure. I can't imagine the fear that these men must have had, even though they're trying to get out of this thing, I'm moving my arms too much. you got this thing spiraling down, and then they're going out. And one particular story that I thought was fascinating was the guy who went out with the co-pilot holding on to his legs. And if you could just tell that story briefly, it's heart-wrenching to me.
That really is the most tragic story of the day to me as well. The co-pilot's parachute was burned, and he came back to the waste of the plane, and his hair was on fire, his uniform was on fire, and so the men were working to get that fire out. And because he didn't have a parachute and there wasn't a spare on board, he made plans to bail out holding on to the radio operator. So he grabbed onto him. They went out of the plane together. But when the parachute snapped open, he lost his grip and fell to his death.
It's a little silent. I know you're not supposed to do that on radio, but it's just amazing. And that man, unfortunately, was haunted by that the rest of his life.
He was. That was a very hard memory for him to share and to talk about. But fortunately for me, he did tell the story, and he actually audiotaped the story, so I have that.
That's good. Well, your dad went out also with his parachute, and it doesn't sound like he went out too well. Kind of ended up floating down on his back. And instead of facing the earth, he's on his back and can't figure out how to flip himself over.
Yes, he had a view of the heavens. He did say he was looking for his plane. There was still the battle going on,
sure,
of course, and a lot of planes flying overhead. So he was searching for his plane to try to see if other people were parachuting from it. And he was just pinned down back up. And so he would try to look to see how far he was from the ground. And the first time he looked, he thought, well, I'm way up.
Mm-hmm.
No problem. And so he just continued to scan the sky. And then when he looked the second time, he said he could actually see individual letters. He thought it was a gas station sign something like that.
He's a little low now.
So he immediately pulled his chute. Fortunately, it worked. And he said he just swung one side and then swung back to the other side and hit the ground. So he hit pretty hard, but he did make it down.
Wow. I just can't imagine that. And Bob, I know you were airborne and you jumped out of a perfectly good airplane, and I just can't fathom the idea of not only are you hurtling toward the earth at, you know, God knows how fast, and then you can't even see the earth, and by the time you see, oh my gosh, there's a gas station, I better pull the chute here.
It's like jumping off the end of a truck at about the truck doing about 25 miles an hour. You're coming down pretty good. You're especially those T-7s is what they had, mm-hmm, and they jumped with. They were much smaller so that they would come down faster, obviously. You don't want to be hanging up there, but it's a pretty good hit.
Yeah, and then, Laura, that's what you mentioned in the book, is that he also didn't want to be hanging there too long because the people on the ground have been known to shoot at the parachutists coming down, and sometimes if you were way up high, some of the airplanes would have started coming at you also. So, all right, so he's down on the ground now in Germany, and we're going to be going to a break in just a second, so you can sit back and relax for just a moment. We're talking with Laura Edge, who is the author of the book On the Wings of Dawn, American Airmen as Germany's Prisoners, story of her dad, Larry Witt, and we're going to be getting into the adventure of surviving the POW camps in Germany when we come back after this break. If you want to get in on the conversation, give us a call, please, 877-573-7825. We'll be right back after this.
For the past 100 years, Amish furniture craftsmen have placed great value upon the beauty and quality of their work, with great attention paid to the details of the wood. Each board is then hand-selected to match the specific furniture in mind and in achieving the desired look of the finished piece. At Naked Furniture of Ann Arbor Showroom, you will find displays of this fine craftsmanship that you can afford and own. Now is the time. You can visit Naked Furniture at 3570 Washtenaw Avenue and experience this fine quality for yourself. The furniture consultants at Naked Furniture of Ann Arbor are there to show you the fine details of Amish furniture. See for yourself the fine quality Amish furniture. Go to Naked Furniture of Ann Arbor, 3570 Washtenaw Avenue, or visit their website, nakedfurnitureofannarbor.com.
You're listening to Veterans Radio right here on WDEO 990 AM.
Back on Veterans Radio, and they don't make music like that anymore, and probably some people say that's just as well. Some people think it's really great.
I don't know why they have those long leads. They're actually Johnny Desmond, who was turned out to be a wonderful writer and recorded on Mercury Records. You don't know how I knew that, but I did. And he's supposed to be singing on this. It's Fly, Fly, Baby. So that was in honor of Larry and our guest, Laura. So, yep, there it was. But
there we go.
They have these long leads.
I know. I think they're just getting everybody ready. I think it gives them enough time to get out onto the dance floor, maybe. I don't know. Anyway, yes, we are back, and we're talking with Laura Edge, author of On the Wings of Dawn, a story of her dad becoming a POW in Germany in 1944, in May of 1944. We've just got him safely down on the ground. And so, Laura, what happens next?
Well, next he runs to the woods, dragging his parachute, hoping to hide. And he's hearing voices. He knows people are out in the woods looking for the men who have just parachuted down. So he ducks behind a tree when he hears voices getting closer. And he sees two men.
The tree.
A very little tree. He knew he was sticking out from both sides of it. But then he sees his crewmate, Willis Boatwright, being led down a path by two German civilians. They spy him, and Willis basically says, "Come on, Larry, we might as well be in this together." And so these two men walk them further down the path. As it turns out, they both had fought in World War I and had been prisoners of war of the British. Okay. So they had a certain degree of compassion, which mm-hmm. certainly benefited my dad
right.
and Willis. But they, as they walked further down the path, some Germans came along, some German military people, and took over. So they eventually end up at an air base. They're transported to an air base not too far from where their plane went down. And there they meet two other of the men that had been in their plane. So the four of them are together at that point in time. The battle is still going on overhead, and they're put in a little bunker. They can watch the battle going on, and then they're loaded onto a truck. At this point in time, the fifth airman from my dad's plane came in And he was brought in on a stretcher. And actually one of the other men from the plane were asked to help unload. And that was James Davis. Mm-hmm. And he was not taken with them to Dulag Loof at that time. And Dulag Loof was the interrogation center, only about 15 miles from this air base. They were trucked down there and all put in solitary confinement. They all were interviewed by the Germans. And the first thing, this is a very common story, the first thing that happens is they're supplied with a Red Cross form. Well, it's a bogus Red Cross form.
Okay.
It starts out looking very legitimate with the logo on the top and all, and it starts first asking for name, rank, serial number, what you are expecting to be asked. But then they want to know home address, and they go further from the more acceptable questions mm-hmm. to ask down to where is your air base, what plane were you on. So the fellows would quickly catch on that this is not a legitimate form to fill out, and they would stop at name, rank, and serial number.
These interrogators, according to your book, also spoke perfect English, and many of them had been in the States prior to the war, and so they were trying to bond with them by talking about places that they had been, similar, you know, this city, that city. You guys were talking about Detroit earlier, you know, oh, remember going down to this place, and the idea is to, you know, get people to open up to them.
And they had a vast archive on our military personnel.
Yeah.
So many of the veterans I interviewed would say to me, they knew more about me than I knew about myself.
Mm-hmm.
They, in some cases, they knew what high school these men went to. They knew what hometown they came from. And in researching this, I found that at Dulag Loof, they had people researching the newspapers from the United States.
Okay.
And so clippings from the newspaper would be sent. Well, a proud family might put an article in the newspaper mm-hmm. that, you know, my son just graduated and he's heading over to England and he's a pilot on a bomber or whatever the case might be. So these newspaper clippings would give them some information about these, and they would keep a file on airmen.
That's pretty amazing when you think about it. There's no internet or computers going on
right
now. They kept all that stuff going. Bob, you had a question?
Yeah, Laura, this is Bob. Where did they keep all this information?
Well, at Dulag Loof, when that was just north of Frankfurt, and they had there all the files on everyone that they could dream up. They even had from England, they would send people over to England, and they would mingle. And I don't even know how they did this, but this was according to the research I did. They could mingle at the dances, even at some of the mm-hmm. air bases. So that was one other way they got information.
I just can't even imagine how they had all this information available to them. I guess I didn't realize how organized the whole POW apparatus was. From, as you point out, you know, from the time you're shot down, you're immediately taken to the Dulag Luft, where they kind of screen you, and then they send you off to the different camps wherever they happen to be. And these camps were divided by officers and non-commissioned officers also, weren't they?
Yes, they had quite a system. So there were officer camps, then there were non-commissioned officer camps for the airmen, and then different camps for ground troops.
Right.
So for the most part, they were separated.
Yeah. Okay, so we know that your father ended up here, and then where was he sent after his initial interrogation?
He was sent to Stalag Luf 4, which is a prison camp up near the Baltic Sea in what is now Poland. And it was a very isolated spot. And the conditions there were pretty barren. When my father got there, he was the second group of prisoners to enter that camp. And he was in the group that was marched out also when the Russians came at the end. So he pretty much was there from the day Stalag Luf 4 opened until the day it closed. And when he first arrived there, only Compound A was opened. So it was a work in progress all the time that he was there as well. By the time he left there, they had started their fifth compound. Conditions became more and more overcrowded as more and more airmen were shot down. And so rooms that were supposed to hold 10, 12 men were 24 men and so on. Double bunks were being replaced with three-decker bunks. My father was eventually moved to Compound C, and when he was first put there, that compound was new, and there were no beds. So they slept on bags that they filled with straw, and that was their beds there. It was cold there, very northern climate, and the stoves to heat these little buildings didn't arrive until November 1st. So conditions were hard, but what was most incredible to me in interviewing the veterans about their experiences there is how they pulled together and how they created basically an American society behind barbed wire. They elected room leaders, they elected the people that would be in charge of them, and they held elections just like they would be held in the United States. They used any resource they had to make their time there as eventful and less boring as possible. And many Christian groups in the United States sent materials to the POWs, and they were utilized to start classes. Instruments were sent by the YMCA, and bands were formed, choral groups were formed.
I think that was fascinating to me when I found out how much flexibility they had to, you know, to pass the time, in essence. Because how many people ended up in the Stalag 4? Do you have any idea?
Well, by the time they marched out, there was probably almost 10,000 men there.
10,000? I want people to kind of chew on that figure. That's 10,000. That's only one camp. So there were many, many thousands of POWs that were, you know, that were caught, especially toward the end of World War II. We're coming up on our last break for the day, so we can relax a little bit. And I want to, when we come back, I want to talk about the march, which was the most difficult part of your dad's capture or time in captivity. So if you want to get in on a conversation, give us a call here at 877-573-7825. We're talking with Laura Edge, who's from Saline, Michigan, and her book is about her dad, and it's called On the Wings of Dawn. We'll be right back.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
You're listening to Veterans Radio right here on WDEO 990 AM.
And we're back on Veterans Radio, a little trip down memory lane with our music today. We're talking with Laura Edge. She's the author of a book about her dad. It's called On the Wings of Dawn, and he was a POW in Germany toward the very end of World War II. And we just had him up in Stalag 4, up in north, eastern Germany, I think, up near Poland. And as the war continues on, the Russians are coming from the east, the Americans and English are coming from the west, and the Germans start moving the POWs to get them out of the way of the Russians. So let's start right there.
Yes, it was toward the end of January in 1945 when the prisoners could start hearing artillery fire, and they knew the lines were getting closer to their camp. And the Germans decided we're not going to have our prisoners taken by the Russians, so they made plans to start evacuating that camp. Around January 30th, a group, or more than one group, went out by train, and they were mostly the POWs who were too weak to travel by foot or had been hospitalized, and they went to various camps. And then the rest, starting on January 7th, started walking out by foot. This was the coldest winter on record in that part of the world, and these men walked on and on, day after day, just carrying their belongings on their back, wearing the same clothes day after day. They often were given shelter in barns along the way. The German farmers were told, open up your barns, and these men would spend the night. Sometimes no shelter could be found, so in the winter they'd be sleeping outside. Very little food was provided on these marches. Every now and then a German soup wagon might find them. They might get a little bit of bread, a little bit of soup. For the most part, they were left to their own devices, and they were searching, digging in farmers' fields, looking for something left over from the harvest, some piece of onion right. or potato.
Well, we have somebody on the phone that wanted to maybe can continue that story just a little bit. And joining us right now from North Carolina is John. And John, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Hi, I'm enjoying listening to it. I had trouble getting in this morning, but I finally got a touch to you.
Oh,
I'm glad.
Good.
I know Laura very well, and I told her I'd try and call today if I could.
Well,
so I'm calling in.
Thank you. This is John Anderson, who helped organize the orchestras and the choral groups in the camp, and he has a little tie to the U of M. He got his master's degree from the University of Michigan here in Ann Arbor. And
we like that.
Well, you know, we got to get a plug out when we can. Laura is just starting to describe the long march, and I know that you participated in that. Could you tell us a little bit what it was actually like for you?
Well, I was probably had not exercised as much as I should during the camp life, and so on the first day of the march, I had trouble with my getting a cramp in my right foot, and I fell to the back of the 2000 formation I was in, and so Steve, who was my a medic that lived in my barracks, and he said, well, there was no tape to do anything. He couldn't do anything to my foot, so I just have to take it as I got it. And so I went back to the front of the formation and told them that they needed to slow down because those guys in the back were going too fast. And so he was trying to keep this one fellow that was and wanted to stop marching. He just couldn't go any further. And that was what was troublesome all the way on the march, was that some guys wanted to stop and fall out. But we were told that you're likely to get shot if you stopped. And so we tried to keep going. And I was fortunate enough to have my roommates with me on this, and they helped carry my pack on the third day, or I don't think I'd have made it. But we did get to the bottom of the hill, and there was a refugee group going up the hill, and I went off the left side of the road, and I looked and I thought I could not make up that hill. And I think it was sort of a miracle that here I found a wagon going up with a back down, and so I threw my pack up on the back and jumped on the back of the cart and rode up the hill. It was being drawn by an old man and evidently his grandson. Grandson told his father, grandfather, that I was on the wagon, and he yelled at me. But he spoke in German, so I didn't understand what he said, but I knew what he meant. But I rode up the hill on that wagon, and after I got up the top of the hill, some guard saw me and made me get off. But I thought that was sort of a miracle that I got up that hill. And we eventually got to a barn and stayed that night. Had a rest on the fourth day, and then we went on. We were supposed to go 3 days, March 1, rest one, and then go two more days. But we really were on the road for 53 days before we arrived at the Falling Botho, which was Camp 11B. And we'd marched about as far as Tampa is from Atlanta, I think, is about the distance we marched. And it was I was unable to march after March 1st. There was a big, heavy snowstorm that day, and you could almost lean into the wind, and it would hold you up. But I went on sick call the next day, and the Dr. Kaplan, who was the one American doctor that was with us, said I could ride on the wagon that day. And so I did, and I shouldn't have done that because my feet froze that day. And then I was unable to really march at all. But I stayed with the group for about two more weeks riding that wagon every day. And then finally they put me in a barn with a medic, and the medic in charge was my friend Steve. So that helped me, and my feet did get better. And I rejoined the group on about the 27th or 8th of March. And we were at a camp at a city where I didn't even have know where I was, but we were put on
you put on the train?
On the train, yes, okay. On the train. They put 53 of us in the one car, which was supposed to be a 40 or 8, which meant it was 40 men or 8 horses. And that's what they used a lot in Germany. They were all over the place. But we got in there in about 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and we were locked in, and we had no facilities at all to use and nothing to drink, nothing to eat. And it was pretty rough there, and the train did not move that night like we thought it would, but we were there all that next day, and then the next night it did move, and we got to Falling Botho and got out of the train and trudged up the hill again to Stalag 11B, and that's where we had been. I understand there was close to 90,000 prisoners there in Falling Botho, so it was a big camp.
Wow.
I thought there was about 10,000, but I heard later on that there were close to 90,000 prisoners of all nationality, and
wow.
I was placed in a tent, and after about 7 days, they decided that they wanted to keep the Air Corps men, so they marched them out, and I missed that formation. I didn't want to march. I knew I couldn't march anymore. I could barely stand up. But I missed the formation. And then they said, well, if you didn't go there, we won't feed you. And we said, well, we were sick. And they said, if you're sick, you go to the hospital. You have your choice, go to the hospital or go marching. So they met a day or so later that we would fall out at noon, and they would examine us, and if we could march, we'd march. If we not, we'd go to the hospital. But they had an air raid at that time. That's another miracle sort of happened. And we had to take cover. We couldn't be outside in an air raid. And they had to go, we'll report the next morning. And so we did. we went to bed that night, and the next day the Germans had left. They left a contingent of soldiers there to handle the duties, and they still held the guns, and they allowed a British soldier to walk with the guard behind outside the gates. But it took another week or two before they arrived. The British Second Army arrived on September 15th at 8:37 in the morning when they arrived. I remember that specifically when they came up to the gate. We got a loaf of white bread the next day, and I ate it immediately because we were so hungry. But it took a little while for us to get checked. It was all by the British, and they tried to delouse us by putting powder all over us. But I finally got the order I was to go out on the cert on the next day.
That's good. John, I hate to interrupt you, but we're going to be running out of time, and I got to kind of wrap this up. But thank you so much for calling in, and thank you for your service to your country.
I enjoyed to listen to you.
Okay. Laura, thank you, John.
All right.
Wow. Time, as I said, goes fast, and we're just coming up at the end of the program. We can get this book by going to the website, which is?
On the Wings of Dawn.
OnTheWingsOfDawn.com. I encourage you to go out and get this book and read this story. When he had some issues coming home that you need to read about and find out about these men and women who came home from World War II. And it's as Laura and I have talked about, we certainly found out a lot more about our dad by the books that we are writing today.
Absolutely.
So, Laura, thank you very much, and I'm hoping that you'll come back to be on Veterans Radio sometime in the future. Until next week, folks, you are dismissed.
All views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily of Veterans Radio or WDEO. Veterans Radio is a production of Veterans Radio, LLC.